welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Candace LePage.
And Candace is wearing her Faculty of Horror t-shirt. I'm wondering, did you let her in any sports at the Faculty of Horror? Or did you
yes,
graduate Magna
fast.
Or Summa? Yeah,
running
okay.
fast.
Walked into
running
that one.
Upstairs quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a real thing, actually. But
yeah.
Probably started at the Faculty of Horror, now that we're talking about it. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. You can find us here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Dwayne Johnson movie, Skyscraper. I think he's a genre
that's
now.
That's Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Oh, well.
Give him his dues.
Yeah, fine. Okay. That's in the back half of the show, though, and I think we'll probably be debating that, but that's fine. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including the Emmy Awards. Nominations were announced Thursday. It turns out the best shows on TV are still the best shows, mostly. And then RoboCop is coming back to the big screen, and it's getting the retcon treatment, but do we really need another RoboCop? And then finally, Die Hard turns 30, and it seems timely that Skyscraper is coming out on the auspicious occasion. But we will talk about why nothing can reach the heights of Die Hard.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. I was watching the Nerdist 90s trailer for Skyscraper, and it's like full of bad puns like that. It's kind of bad. But anyway, first topic, though, is our old friend Scarlett Johansson apparently did not learn the lessons of Ghost in the Shell, in which people will recall she plays a Asian woman who's in a white woman's android body, and that, although that's kind of not the original storyline.
Not even a little bit.
Not even a little bit, based on the manga and the anime of the same name. But she was cast in this movie called Rub and Tug, which is based on a true story of a man named Dante Tex Gill, who was a transgendered man and a gangster in 70s and 80s Pittsburgh, who ran a crime syndicate out of a... well, as the title says, a massage parlor, an erotic massage parlor. And not surprisingly, there are a lot of activists and allies of trans people who thought that having a cis woman play a trans man, probably not the message you want to send in 2018.
Yeah. So, and I will say, actually, that I think it's not that Scarlett Johansson didn't learn her lesson. It's that... the name of the director who also worked with her on Ghost in the Shell.
Right.
He's the person who didn't learn the lesson. Because, I mean, he very much did not learn the lesson of Ghost in the Shell, because he just turned around and did the exact same thing. And I would say that Scarlett Johansson actually did learn a lesson, because she has stepped away from the movie.
Right.
Which is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It does make me wonder if any... a transgendered person will want to work with this particular director, which is sort of too bad, because it does sound like a really interesting story. And I can understand why Scarlett Johansson would have said yes originally, just without thinking, because she is probably one of the most bankable female stars in Hollywood right now. So it's not like she's not getting good roles.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as roles go, I'm sure that that's just like, this would be so interesting to get to know this person and to you know, just peel back all these layers and find something really, really interesting to act.
Yeah.
So I can understand why she said yes originally, thinking only of herself, and that's not a problem. That's what we all do. We all think only of ourselves.
Motives are rarely unselfish.
That's why we have allies. And
right.
I'll use the air quotes, because some people find the word a little objectionable, allies. But that's why we have people to speak out on things, because we all do make decisions based on ourselves generally. And without the experience of other people, we don't think of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was right... I can understand why she said yes. I think it's great that people spoke up about it, and that she actually did say, oh, yeah, I see why this is a problem.
Right.
And I think the problem primarily, from what I understand, isn't... I mean, it certainly is that they're hiring a woman to play a trans man. That's a problem on its own. But the equal problem is that transgender actors can only act transgender roles.
Yeah.
I mean... we don't, not that we ever did before, but we certainly do not cast homosexual actors only in homosexual roles. Yeah. There was a time when it was like people couldn't talk about that because then they could never play the leading man, right? If we think about like Rock Hudson or something like that.
Yeah.
But those times have passed, and now, you know, gay and lesbian actors are able to play straight romance.
Yeah.
As icky as that is for any of us to see. So I'm not a huge fan of the romance genre.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not even necessarily romance. Like Matt Bomer, who is identifies as a gay man, but
and
is
pretty.
He is pretty, and that's why he gets all these.
Sorry,
like,
I just have to throw that.
Yeah, that's why he gets all these meaty leading man parts where he's always yes. wooing a woman.
Yeah,
you know, thinking about you know Magic of What Mike or you know his show White Collar, which I actually enjoyed as fluffy entertainment. But yeah, I think you hit upon a couple of things. First of all, it is a fascinating story, and one of the Pittsburgh papers has like. An article where it lays out like the story of Tex Gill, and you know this is like almost sounds like the Wild West. You know, there are like letter bombs involved of like masseuses opening letter bombs and like storefronts blowing up in Pittsburgh. It's and, you know, and this is just 30, 40 years ago. It's incredible, but yeah, I think to what you said about her seeing a good role, I thought the same thing. And I was listening to the Keep It podcast, and they're talking about it. This has been part and parcel for a while of actors who want to be seen as stretching and as testing themselves. Well, like, I know I will play a person dressing up as a woman or dressing up as a man, something like Trans America, you know, Kiss
Though
the
Spider
Woman.
Though I do love Felicity Huffman.
Yeah, and the person who mentioned that sort of gave it like a little asterisk saying at least she was a woman playing a man who was a woman. So they're, you know, at least the genders lined up in that way. But this does fall on Rupert Saunders. I think it falls a bit on Johansson because there was an initial statement they were like that where she did, you know, cite you know, Jeffrey Tambor in Transparent and Felicity Huffman as like previous examples of cisgender people playing transgender people. And it's, you know, I feel like there's been a lock turn though. And that's to, you know, Trans America wasn't that long ago. I think it was about 10 years ago. So, but there's been a lock turn since then. There's a whole new door. And I think when it comes to roles like this, this isn't to say that a cis person can never play a trans person again, but this is a real life trans figure in an era where, you know, he was a criminal, Tex Gill.
Yeah.
But I mean, he was doubly making life difficult for himself being a trans person in the 70s and 80s and openly trans at that. So it's, you know, this is like a really meaty role. And there was one trans actress, Trace Lazette, who, to your point, said that, you know, I can't go out on audition for the roles that Jennifer Lawrence and Scarlett Johansson get, but they are coming for the roles, you know, that trans people, the few roles that trans people can get. So, you know, maybe until the day, you know, we can have Trace Lazette audition for Black Widow, you know, maybe that's, that's where we have to be in terms of, as you said, you know, only gay people can do play gay parts, and you know, maybe that's the first step to making that leap to the Matt Bomer phase where he's a gay man who's romancing women on screen.
Yeah, it's called acting.
It's
they
called
can
acting.
Do it.
Yeah.
They can pretend to be whatever.
Right. No, you're right. It's it's true, but I think that there's a mental and career leap that has to be made first, that you know that a trans actor can do any part and not just the trans parts.
Yeah.
Anyway. Speaking of breaking walls down, Sandra Oh, first woman of Asian descent to be nominated for Best Actress.
Amazing.
For the Emmys.
Which
and
I did sort of think, wow, that's so great. That's been so long in the making. And I'm like, actually, no, it hasn't been that long in the making because I think she's probably the first Asian woman who has ever led a show, a dramatic series.
Which
that is a real abomination. That's where the problem is.
It's and it's a BBC show called Killing Eve. I think it's going to be airing on Bravo in the next couple of weeks, and I might check it out. I mean, I was interested in checking it out before. But Yeah, so that's part of the Emmy cycle, the Emmy Awards, giving out for primetime TV shows. Game of Thrones had the most awards. We're not going to go down the whole list, but Game of Thrones had the most with 22. Handmaid's Tale had the second most with 20. And, you know, a lot of the usual suspects, SNL, Westworld, Stranger Things, This Is Us. You know, another thing I found interesting, Ted Danson, I mean, just from a statistics point of view, Ted Danson, one of the few network nominees for Best Actor in a Comedy Series, but he's now had the most nominations for Best Actor, beating both Kelsey Grammer and Alan Alda.
He has had a very long career in some really great television, right? Like, Cheers was on for how many years? It's between
10
8
or
and
11.
13? Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, it's 10 or 11.
Yeah, and I mean, he was there the whole time.
Yeah.
So, of course. And then, what was his show was just called Ted, wasn't it? He had, I don't know.
He had a show where he was like a curmudgeonly doctor before House.
Oh yeah.
And he was on Original Recipe CSI for a while.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh.
He replaced William Peterson.
Original Recipe. Did he really?
No. Huh. No. He replaced Lawrence Fishburne, who replaced Lawrence Peterson. Lawrence Fishburne, who replaced William Peterson.
Oh, so it was late Original.
It was
Recipe
late era.
CSI.
Yeah. It was like the final era CSI. The late Cretaceous of CSI. I think he was on Damages too.
Yep, that sounds right.
So, I mean, yeah, he gets around.
So great in A Good Place. I haven't seen any of the second season because, or any of the other shows that are nominated because I don't have cable and I don't subscribe to Hulu or anything. I subscribe to Netflix, and so I see things when they show up on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tend to be a year behind the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
That's all right. You do get Riverdale.
I do, and I do watch it weekly.
CW things, yeah. but also Stranger Things. David Harbour was a Best Supporting Actor, and I think that's great because I think he's the heart of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and he's up. I mean, that's a pretty strong category because you got Kristoff Waldau, who's Kingslayer in Game of Thrones, and you know, I'm not sure he's quite deserving because a lot of what they did this season of Game of Thrones was like setting up for like the inevitable confrontation. So, I mean, I find that paradox in terms of like how many Game of Thrones nominated because I felt that this season was all about the maneuver for the last six episodes, and
was it mostly because their last season didn't qualify?
Yeah,
so
that's right too.
They're kind of
they took the season off, so it premiered in the summer, so it wasn't eligible for last year, so it might have been overcompensating. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's, you know, Matt Smith for The Crown too. So I mean, that's a tough. I would love to see David Harbour win that category. I'd also love to see Thandi Newton win for Westworld because I think she's the best part of that show.
Interesting. That is a show that I definitely have to watch. I feel bad that I haven't watched any of it because I'm pretty sure that I should be able to see some of it by now.
Yeah, no, I think the season two had, I'm not sure it should have been nominated for best series because I think there were only like a couple of episodes that were really stand out. And one of them was the one that took place in Shogun World, which is the samurai park, and that heavily featured Thandi Newton waving a katana around and fighting a bunch of guys. So I mean,
that's
it was very appealing. Samantha Bee is up for the Samantha Bee show.
The variety
Full Frontal, best variety, forcing out Jimmy Fallon, which I think is correct.
It's the way it should be. And I noticed Tracy Ullman's show, which I was like, what? Really? She's on the air again? I mean, that's great. I loved Tracy Ullman back in the day, so I'm excited that she's still working.
She's still banging, yeah. And then another kind of weird mention was Laurie Metcalf was like one of two nominations for Roseanne. I feel like that's like I feel like it's because it's Laurie Metcalf.
Yeah,
if it wasn't Laurie Metcalf. It was...
I would agree. I mean, she deserves every nomination she gets.
Yeah,
having just recently rewatched Scream 2.
She is kind of great. She's like that end scene where she's completely mad. It's great. Mm-hmm. And then another weird one that I was not too with was like Alec Baldwin for Best Supporting Actor for playing Trump every other week.
That's kind of like
we're sticking it to Trump, and I don't know. That's
ridiculous.
I don't care for that.
Yeah.
and then Handmaid's Tale is it's great because it's got that Canadian connection, and you know, we'll continue to see, you know, handmaidens walking around downtown Cambridge
downtown
for
Galt.
A couple of more years. Yeah. And I think we all enjoy that, and yeah, so good. Good news. Good news, Emmys. I got nothing else to add.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of... that's not even a segue. Anyway, moving on. RoboCop.
Did you catch that segue?
Yeah.
RoboCop.
Yada yada segue RoboCop.
Yeah.
I initially, when I saw the talent, I was like, they're going to remake RoboCop again. But no, they're actually the two guys that wrote RoboCop, Ed Neumauer and Michael Miner, wrote a sequel, and it had been on the shelf for
all these years.
30 years. yeah. And so somebody at MGM is wanting to develop it with Neil Blomkamp as the director. So I take it, you know, maybe we'll get a D'Antwerp cameo, maybe. Fingers crossed. No, that's not a real thing. Anyway, but I think it's interesting because I was going to be like, do we really have to go back to RoboCop? But then there was a line in the original article where they were talking about what might be in the plot. And apparently the screenwriters predicted that a reality TV star would become president. And I was like, if that's a thing, then I wonder what else might be awaiting in this script.
Yeah, so I was sort of the same way because you sent me the article with just the line, do we need more RoboCop? So I didn't actually read the article. I just pulled out RoboCop because I bought it. Used recently, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right, I should totally rewatch this because I haven't seen it in years. So I did rewatch it, and it's just like, it's still so good, it holds up, it's so Verhoeven. So
yeah,
some people might be, though I think it's less Verhoeven than Starship Troopers.
Yeah,
that one I think really went over people's heads, whereas RoboCop is a little bit less satirical, so people can get it. But like, it is so brutal to watch. So I'm watching it going, I can't imagine this movie being remade for current times being any more brutal. Like the scene of Murphy being killed is just like, how did I watch this when
it's
I was
over
a kid?
The top.
It is, yeah, it is pretty, pretty brutal. And like, there's tons of other brutality in it. And also some weird sex and drugs stuff. Like it's a, I don't know what it was rated at the time, but it should definitely be rated R.
even the scene, even like the when Miguel Ferrer gets killed.
Yeah.
I think it's the Ed 209 that kills him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's...
Dick kills him straight up. Ronnie Cox kills him straight up. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Somebody else gets killed by the Ed 209 in what's a demonstration.
Yes.
And that is, I think, I find that one more brutal because it's in like the harsh light of the corporate office.
Yeah.
Imagine your work just like blowing up into a war zone and someone being riddled with 1,000 bullet holes in the conference room.
Yeah, so I did, I mean, I mostly rewatched it thinking, how would you remake this? Because something like Dread... And even Total Recall, I think, actually really were very good remakes. But I feel like RoboCop doesn't need it. But then, you know, reading the article and understanding a little bit more, I'm like, okay, I can see where this might work, especially with someone like Neil Blomkamp, because much like...
Chappie.
I was District thinking 9. Of the French-Canadian director,
Denis Villeneuve.
Right. He redid Blade Runner
because
he loved Blade Runner. I think this is the same sort of thing that, you know, someone who grew up with it and has a certain reverence for it could actually do something interesting and not JJ Fanservice Abrams.
You know, you're right. It's, I think where Blomkamp's fell on his face lately is on his own material, and Chappie and Elysium have good ideas that are necessarily well thought out, versus something like District 9, which started as a short, and then he was able to flesh it out. And I wonder if he had just like gone straight up and made a feature version of District 9, if that wouldn't have just fallen on his face, if he hadn't done that sort of research in terms of where he wanted to take the message first. And of course, that's what he's been doing lately, is making, building, I think it's Oat Studios, making short films.
In Vancouver, apparently.
Yeah, it is. That was, I mean, the dollar's probably attractive, and but also a big film industry.
Oh,
there,
yeah, so. There's talented people working there.
Giving him the keys to the universe and a script that's already been sort of developed, it could yield interesting results, I think. I think I'd be interested in seeing another RoboCop more than I'm interested in seeing another Terminator, because the guy who's writing the new Terminator movie that's being like overseen by James Cameron, allegedly, and directed by Tim Miller, Justin Rhodes, he's doing the rewrite. But I think there's more meat to a RoboCop because of, you know, where we are as a society. And I think there were a lot of good ideas.
Yeah, what the themes always were. The themes of Terminator are not really themes that are present in our minds right now.
I used to think that there would be a good opportunity to remake Terminator, given what we know about AI and computers and the internet now. But I think Genesis shot that straight to you know where. But RoboCop, the RoboCop remake, which I have seen a couple of times, once in the theater and once on TV, just, you know, channel surfing, it has some interesting ideas in it, but because it's having to fight against what I think we can agree is the near perfection of the Verhoeven version, it couldn't really stand on its own. And so perhaps just following the straight line from RoboCop 87 to whatever this is going to be might get some creative juices flowing.
Yeah, better results.
Better results. And, you know, I hope so, because, you know, I think making a mass market film about evil corporate types, and, you know, and a man literally struggling against the machine, I think it would speak to a lot of people. And, of course, like awesome kills and violence and blowing up stuff. And
Yep. Can we also just take one moment to remember what a bombshell Nancy Allen was? For whatever reason, she just kind of disappeared a little bit. And she's not really commonly remembered as, you know, someone like a great actress from the late 70s and early 80s.
Yeah.
But, you know, Carrie and
underused, too.
Yeah.
She was in 1941. Because I actually watched that a couple of years ago. And, oh, God, Spielberg, what were you thinking? But she's underused. But she's, like, I don't know, you know, what she's been up to lately. But she had a small part in Out of Sight. Mm-hmm. And she's still a bombshell in that. Speaking of, I was going to say bombshells. Probably shouldn't make that joke. But so Die Hard just turned 30 last week, and it seemed like a good way to set up the review of the week, that, you know, we have an action movie set in a tall building, and we have the movie this week is an action movie set in a tall building, although it's funny because people have been calling Skyscraper, it's Die Hard in an office building.
Isn't that what Die Hard was?
Exactly.
It was Die Hard in an office building.
But it's funny because Die Hard is, you know, set up a whole little subgenre, because you can go into a pitch meeting and go, oh, this is Die Hard in a plane, or Die Hard in the White House. Or
It's basically the Jaws of action films, right?
That's
like, because Jaws is the same thing, right? It's Jaws only with an octopus.
Yeah.
It's Jaws with, you know, things falling from the sky.
Yeah, it's funny because I was Googling Die Hard to look at, you know, other retrospectives, and there were actually a couple of listicles that are like the best Die Hard ripoffs, or the best best films in the Die Hard genre. Yeah. But it's funny, the Slash Film had the a sort of retrospective talking to some of the key people involved, like Jan DeBont and Reginald Veljohnson. And it's considering its place in the culture, you know, what it reminds me is sometimes the best stuff is sort of made on the fly. Not that Die Hard was entirely made on the fly, but there were a lot of hurdles for it to overcome. Mm-hmm. One was finding a star. Bruce Willis was not the first pick.
Yeah. No, and I think that it's, you know, sometimes luck is actually what makes a film great, and that's what happened with Bruce Willis.
And then Yann DuBont was talking about how they didn't storyboard much. And it's so weird in this area where, you know, you have things pre-visualized up the hilt. Mm-hmm. You know, so you pretty much know how something's going to look before you even shoot a milligram of that. I don't know, because it's not tape anymore. It's not film.
It's a megabyte.
A megabyte of film. Thank you. but it's, you know, it's interesting to read Yann DuBont talk about how they were improvising on set and telling John McTiernan that they needed, like, real locations to sell the authenticity. Because we'll get into this with Skyscraper, but I think one of the things that still makes Die Hard so great is that it's in an office building. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the characters are running around in, like, real hallways and real elevator shafts and... there's a realness to it, and I think even the franchise itself has lost that, because by the time you get to part four and John McClane's jumping off fighter planes onto the bridge below, you know, you've officially lost the thing that has made the Die Hard, the original Die Hard, but also the subsequent Die Hards, you know, what they were, which is
because it was both the realness of the place but also the realness of the person doing those things, right? Like John McClane really got hurt, which we might come back to again also.
He gets beat up. But that's what's great about the ending when he confronts the film is about Hans and McClane's sort of match of wits, but they never come face to face until the end, and you kind of forget that because they do have this dialogue through the whole film where they're testing each other, and so there is the scene where they where he finds Hans and Hans tries to pretend he's a hostage, but like in terms of actual confrontation, like, they don't really meet as the nemesis until the end. And when McClane comes in, and he's got like two bullets left, but he is a wreck. His shirt is gone. He's covered in soot and blood. His feet are wrapped in paper and toilet paper because he's cut his feet. He just looks like crap. And that is, when you think about the James Bond movies now, that used to never be a thing. James Bond never have a hair out of place, let alone get like cut and broken bones and all that. It's just there's a crunchiness to that sells it, let's say. And then Reginald Val Johnson, I mean, there are so many people who, like, this was a big thing. There was Alan Rickman, who was, this was his first movie. Bruce Willis had done a couple of movies, but this was like his first big thing after Moonlighting. And Reginald Val Johnson, this was his first big role.
Yeah, I guess so.
And,
eh?
Yeah, and reading his interview, he's like, you know, I didn't realize how important my part was until, you know, I saw the movie, and it's so weird because
basically like the third.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's the third lead, and he's sort of the anchor. There's a very human element outside of Bonnie Bedelia, who as the wife, but I mean, he's the other sort of core human element that keeps John McClane grounded through the film. And sadly, now most people know Reginald Val Johnson as Urkel's foil, but are you going to do? All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with our review of Die Hard in an Office Building. Skyscraper. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Yeah. magnets are going to kick back on once you pass the fire line. But I need you to pull this handle in order to engage the braking system. It's about 500 feet from here until the fire line. I want you to count to five and pull the handle.
This is crazy.
Trust me.
Okay.
You don't, buddy.
I'm scared.
It's okay to be scared. In order to be brave, we gotta be a little scared. Right? And I need you to be brave right now. Can you do that for me?
Yeah.
I want you to hold on to your mom. Dad lives who?
Me.
That's right. Okay.
Okay, we're gonna sit down. We're gonna brace ourselves, all right? Okay.
I love you.
You better.
And that was a clip from Skyscraper. It is the new film from Ross and Marshall Thurber, and it stars Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Thank you.
Nev Campbell, Pablo Schreiber, Noah Taylor, Roland Moeller, Byron Mann, and Chin Han. And I think it's great that Dwayne Johnson is remaking all the old Irwin Allen classics. He did Earthquake a couple of years ago, and now he's doing The Towering Inferno. I mean, that...
And I enjoyed them both.
You a fan of San Andreas?
I really found it super fun.
It is fun, yeah. It
fun, and also way more than this movie, San Andreas is totally unbelievable on so many things, so it's so much fun. It's like a good, yell at the TV screen movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of... I feel like it's unintentional comedy from Paul Giamatti, but it works just the same. That, you know, he's playing it so straight that you can't help but laugh about, you know, when he's like, they're going to feel it on the East Coast. it's so strong. There's a lot of... Ian Griffin is so slimy in that when he finally gets killed, it's very satisfying. But I think with Skyscraper, I saw a lot of the quote-unquote twist coming. Like, everyone who showed up who ended up being a bad guy, even though you're supposed to have, like, suspension of disbelief, I'm like, oh, that person's one of the bad guys. Almost every time.
These are supposed to be twists? I just figured... I mean...
I think it's set up that way. Like, if you've never seen a movie before, you might be surprised.
Yeah, no, I kind of figured... So my take on this movie is that it executed exactly what it was trying to execute well. It did not stray from the formula whatsoever. And it introduced, like, here we're introducing the... Here's the point that is going to be, you know, at the end, this is going to be important. And here's the person that we know. Like, everything, I think it did exactly what it was supposed to do in exactly the order it was trying to. Like, this isn't original, you know, high art. Like, you don't have to think. It's just well-executed action.
I think it's okay. And I think one of the things it does well, one of the things that San Andreas did really well was, like, it made our hero characters not dumb.
Yes.
And I enjoyed that a lot. In San Andreas, although it's all about The Rock and his wife trying to save the daughter in San Francisco, there are so many scenes of the daughter being smart and of knowing, because her father is a rescue pilot and a paramedic, so she knows. So there's an inference that she spent time listening to her father about his job and knowing things and knowing what to do in a crisis and being clear-headed and level-headed in a crisis. And I like that. And that was also a part of this here.
Yeah, it was very clear. I really liked that. I love that Nev Campbell actually got to... Yeah. I do really, really enjoy Nev Campbell as an actress. I always like to see her in things, and I especially like to see her as the... every woman who actually can get things done.
Yeah.
Which was basically what she plays, right? I mean, even when you think about Sydney Prescott and Scream, which I've recently rewatched a few of them. She plays the kind of person you could see yourself as, who's just like, oh, this is just the smart thing to do in this situation.
Right. And that was something that was always really smart about the Scream movies, was that Sydney is someone who knows that no one's coming to save her, and she has to save herself. And I think that the smart thing here was it sets up the Neve Campbell character as a Navy doctor, so mm-hmm. she has would have presumably advanced fight training. So
yeah,
with
right.
the bad
three
guys,
three tours in Afghanistan.
Yeah, yeah. So it's,
three.
It's right
people,
there.
Three is a lot of tours.
But yeah, probably about the average number of tours anybody yeah. in the military has done in Afghanistan at this yeah. point. But so you know when the kids are threatened, she can fight back, mm-hmm. and she can you know. Look after her son. This is another one of the things that's set up that the son has asthma, so I wonder if that's going to come into play when the yeah, building's on
of
fire.
Of course. I mean, you introduce these things so that you can check it off, you know, here's the checkbox. Okay.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's very smart where, you know, when the fire goes off in the building and she doesn't mm-hmm. lose her head, instead she takes the time to prepare the kids and mm-hmm. gets cloths wet and wraps yeah. them up. And
has them help, too, so they yeah. understand.
Right.
What their role is, what they're doing, why they're doing it.
Right. And I find and that part of it I found all very satisfying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also it comes into play nicely that she knows Mandarin. And
yes.
later she's dealing with the cops.
Yeah.
But I think Johnson's, you know, the Rock, I think, you know, he's probably why these movies are successful.
Yeah,
someone
absolutely.
Else in another
he's
role.
He's why but, I go see them.
Yeah, he's infinitely charismatic, mm-hmm. and I think one of the problems here is they tried to make him vulnerable, and it's hard to make someone with Johnson's mass
yeah.
vulnerable. Like, yeah. there's one scene where, you know, you're meant to believe, like, two, like, skinny flunkies are able to, like beat him up and hold him down.
Yeah.
It's like, why? Because he has a fake leg in this one.
I know. And even just, yeah, because we're introduced pretty early on that he has lost a leg during, you know, it's been 10 years since he's lost it.
Yeah.
And not that I think that a person without, you know, missing one leg can't be fit, but can that person be Dwayne Johnson fit?
That's a great question.
So he's missing from the knee down on his right leg. His right thigh is still really big.
Yeah.
Like, what exercises you do for
yeah.
that?
That prosthetic leg is made of vibranium. I appreciate what he's trying to do here and mm-hmm. say, like, this is, I am not, he's openly saying, I am not the He-Man here.
Yeah.
But he's still Dwayne Johnson.
I know. Yeah, there's a little bit of it. I'm like, you know, whatever. I'll let it be. He could have had the Tooth Fairy, you know, Dwayne Johnson size and done this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it might have seemed a little more, you might have been a little more tense or a little more like, ooh, is he actually going to do this? I don't know. Would you ever think, is he actually going to do this? He's obviously always going to do this.
Right. Right. I mean, and then going back to Bruce Willis, though, Bruce Willis wasn't a Hulk, you know. He was fit.
Yeah.
But he's very believably fit as, like, a mm-hmm. policeman who would have to have some sort of physical.
Yeah, he was lean and athletic.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Although one of the things I did like about the character is that it shows him, you know, being able to improvise. There's a bit of a MacGyver thing.
Oh, yeah.
With him.
With duct tape. Which clearly got a lot of money, or paid a lot of money. One or the other.
One would hope. But yeah, I think this is probably the best duct tape plug since Red Green.
Yeah. I did not know duct tape could do as many things as it did.
Yeah.
Now I understand how Spider-Man does it.
Yeah, exactly right. So, you know, those parts of it I enjoyed. Just like scenes of characters being clever and being able to improvise. And also I like the idea because he's a retired FBI agent. That's how he lost his leg, was on the job. And throughout the movie, at the beginning of the movie, he talks about how he hasn't touched a gun in 10 years because he's taken this job as like a security consultant. Mm-hmm. And I like how through 99% of the film, he stays true to that. He's like, this is a guy who can, you know, climb a skyscraper, like leap from cranes into buildings, you know, maneuver on the side of them like Spider-Man.
Count the wind turbine turns and perfectly time jumping.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And then he doesn't need a gun to do any of it. And then there's like there's the one thing in the end where he doesn't actually use the gun, but he still takes the gun.
Yeah. Well,
that
you know.
Yeah. Still.
I do, yeah. So there are a lot of parts of this movie that I'm like, I don't think physics works that way.
You think so?
But as I say, a lot fewer times than when I was watching San Andreas.
So, right.
But yeah, there were certainly some times I was like, I don't think. And then similarly, as we've already said, we know he's Dwayne Johnson fit, but do we really think that he can climb 100 floors on the outside of a crane?
Right.
Like, that's a lot of exercise.
That was that was a little much, yeah. Especially when he could have just, like, broke the lock on the elevator door.
I know. If he can climb that long, he's clearly got the muscle power to have broken the lock.
Yeah. But I think part of that was meant to, like, build the suspense of...
Oh, I know.
You know, it's... I mean, there's... I think that actually, that part of the film was ruined by how much of that it showed in the trailer. I'm not one of these people like, I refuse to watch trailers because I don't want to be spoiled. But there was a lot of the crane jumping in the trailer.
Not only that, like, the poster is actually him jumping off the crane into the... Right, and there's that meme about, you know, how...
Yeah.
Where he'd have to be to have made the jump and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so of course, I mean, we all saw that coming, obviously. It was right there, but...
I mean, it's the money shot, so naturally it's in the trailer, but I think too much of the actual scene was shown. So it lacks that sort of tension, which is what they're trying to go for in you know, having him climb up.
Yeah.
And...
Though I did appreciate that they really didn't often go to the trope of him... slipping, like, oh, one hand slips and oh my god. They really held off on those until further into the movie, and then it happened a little bit more frequently, and maybe might have, because he would have been exhausted.
Yeah, right.
But you know, early on during that particular thing, I was like, oh, we've watched him climb for a really long time and never once has he faltered. I'm glad we haven't had this thing happen that is so, I mean, it happens all the time. But.
Well, there's an inversion in one of the scenes, because one of them is of his leg slipping. his prosthetic leg slipping.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that puts kind of a hat on it. Not to keep going back to the comparisons to Die Hard, but I think one of the things that sets Die Hard apart is that you had a colorful array of henchmen. And that's something that Die Hard did really, really well, is that even if the henchman doesn't have a lot of lines, they have a character. Like, there's this one scene where they're coming in for the police raid, and the one guy crouches behind the concession stand, and he looks down, looks around, and then starts pocketing Clark bars or something. And, you know, that's it's those little character touches that I think take the movie to the next level. I think that was what was missing here, is that there was one bad guy, the female who steals the tablet, who I thought she should have been the main bad guy, because she almost says nothing, but she's got so much personality.
Yeah.
But the bad guys were not the
best.
Yeah,
I would agree. Even the sort of the main, like the head of the crime syndicate, was not particularly charismatic. Like, you know, when you look at Hans Gruber, like, I mean, still people, a lot of people find that to be Alan Rickman's best performance.
Yeah.
Which I don't think it was his best performance. Let's be realistic. But it is, like, it's such a charismatic character. And what was his name? Botan or something? Yeah. He was not...
I have to look it up. I mean, that's how badly we did not...
Yeah, he was...
Botha. Cora's Botha.
Yeah. He was not interesting.
No.
Not... I mean, there was... Yeah. It took me a couple of times seeing him to realize, oh, that's the same guy we saw in the other scene. Like, even... He even looked, like, not that interesting. It was... Yeah. So I think that definitely... is a flaw.
But he's Eastern European bad guy standard casting, which is...
I did find all of the other casting to be great. I mean, the film takes place in...
Hong Kong?
Okay, I couldn't remember if it was Hong Kong or Shanghai. But so it does take place in Hong Kong, and there are a number of really great performances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the two police officers out on the ground were great, and the guy who built the building... was interesting. I found him very interesting, because in some ways he did seem a little creepy, a little like,
yeah,
there's something a little off about this guy, but yet still likable. Like, you still wanted to, like, I wasn't put off by him, but it was kind of like,
yeah,
there's something here.
Yeah, you were wondering if he was in on it.
Yeah,
and yeah, that's Chin Han, who he's sadly one of these actors who, if we need an Asian, middle-aged Asian man, let's get Chin Han. He was probably most famous for playing the mob banker in The Dark Knight.
The one I didn't see.
Oh, well, there you go.
Kept falling asleep.
I forgot about that, but Chin Han gets around. Chin Han does get work. So I thought he was a good. And yeah, I liked Byron Mann, who was the head police officer. Mm-hmm. I think that this is great. Great Asian casting. But I mean, it feels like it's not a fluke or like a. Like a, I don't know, like we're a gimmick that it's set in Hong Kong, that we get a lot of really great Asian actors just playing their part. And I still kind of wish, though, that the bad guys had a bit more zip because, you know, it's otherwise it's about Dwayne Johnson versus the building. And that might be fine.
Well,
but
yeah. And I mean, there is a certain interest in that,
yeah,
like,
but I think the building should have been more of a character if that was more the direction they wanted to go in. The only thing about the building is kind of its height, and it's, you know, I'm not saying this should have been like booby traps, it should have been like Home Alone or something, but I think if you have a building that's like so technically sophisticated and that there's like a full like blooming forest in the center of the building with wind turbines and everything, they could have built in some more stuff to show off the ingenuity of the Dwayne Johnson character, and you know,
because he didn't really, except for at the end, he didn't really go to the building really to learn anything. You did play the clip, which was sort of the first time that he showed any sort of knowledge of the building,
right?
When helping his wife and son get out, which I really liked that. I was like, oh, that's right. It's like you had sort of
studied this building,
right? You'd forgotten until he got there, and it's like, oh, and then now he's inside now, so maybe he's going to start using it. And he didn't really use his knowledge of the building until the very end. I do think when I was watching the movie, I did sort of feel like it's Die Hard meets Gremlins 2. Because if you remember, in Gremlins 2, it was the mall, and then the skyscraper had it, which was, you know, totally all computer automated and everything. And the Gremlins got in and started wreaking havoc on the building's control systems.
I think I would have liked it better if John Glover had been the guy who built the building. Now that we're talking about it. Yeah, Gremlins 2 doesn't get referenced enough.
Glad I could help.
Yeah, it's so great. But yeah, I think that would have been a more, because there's no bad guys in San Andreas. It's just about The Rock, like trying to get out of an earthquake.
Time.
Time is the enemy.
Isn't it everyone's enemy?
As Malcolm McDowell said in Star Trek Generations, time is a predator. It's stalking you.
Wow.
Anyway, so it didn't really, I don't think it really needed the bad guys, but I wish that it had picked one. Either the bad guy is the building on fire, or the bad guys are the bad guys. And the MacGuffin that they're all after, too, I didn't really get. I mean, I understood what it was, but it seemed kind of silly and convoluted to be a MacGuffin that all these bad guys are after. Instead of just, like, you know, I hired a bunch of, like, Eastern European whack jobs to build this, to burn this thing down because I can't. For the insurance money or something like that, or just a straight up natural disaster. Like, this is the building that cannot be brought down and it's on fire or something like that.
And I mean, what was that building made out of that was that much on fire and not collapsing?
That's a great point.
Right? I was like, I'm sure if this was steel, that pearl would have come down.
I'm
would
sure
have bent in half.
I'm sure that will be the subject of the next Zeitgeist movie in that universe.
Yeah.
But you make an. I actually had that thought myself in the movie. And it's
And it was just the one floor, and it was like, okay, I can see how this, you know, could be kind of contained, and you know, people above them wouldn't really be a problem. Eventually, it'll just run out of oxygen or whatever.
Yeah, but which then, is what the fire suppression.
Yeah. But then as it started, you know, expanding to other floors, and literally, like, because it started at 96.
Yeah.
And the top floor was like 200 and something.
Yeah.
So, like, there was 100 floors on fire.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know what super metal that was made out of that doesn't conduct heat.
Yeah, and I would think they'd have to evacuate, like, several city blocks.
People were awfully close to that building. I did actually appreciate the sort of the street, like, everybody on the street and everybody, you know, either watching their cameras or whatever. And it must have been in some sort of, like, Times Square-esque part of Hong Kong, because there was really big screens that everybody could watch all of the action on. And how were they getting the footage? Presumably it's drones, because we were already told that they couldn't, the helicopters, because it was too hot, because
then
the draft. Yeah, so helicopters, like, things couldn't fly over there. So how are they getting this really incredible footage of Dwayne Johnson duct taping himself to the side of the building?
That's such an excellent question, because one of the things I had thought of watching the movie, that there could have been a unique statement made about all these people watching this event on their phone or on some sort of screen, when it's like the tallest building in Hong Kong, so all you have to do is look up.
Yeah, but it's 200 floors up.
It sure.
What did it say? Like 3,000 feet or something? I don't know.
It's three
over a
Empire
mile.
State buildings.
Yeah.
And it's taller than the Burj Khalifa.
How's the air up there? Once he exited the building, would it be thinner air? I don't know.
More than likely, there probably been some pressure issues as well.
Yeah. It didn't stop him from doing it. Didn't stop
that's
him
how
from
tough,
being it.
That's how tough The Rock is.
He could still count, keep his head clear and count.
He can
how
beat
quickly.
Barometric pressure.
I wish I could beat barometric pressure, but unfortunately it causes me migraines.
The Rock is better than barometric pressure.
The Rock is better than a lot of things. Let's be reasonable.
Yeah. I think one of the... there was only like kind of one scene that made me kind of like straight up acrophobic, and I wonder, like, I don't know if there's an IMAX version of this.
So you watched in 3D and I did not, and I didn't think of it while I was watching it much until afterwards, and I went, oh yeah, people who watch that in 3D, ooh. So you're talking about when they're up in the Pearl and all of the
There's that. By the way, Chekhov's holodeck, and that's all I'll say about that. But when they're up in the Pearl, and it's kind of laid out the whole city underneath them, and then just like scenes of him looking down and things.
Yeah.
I feel like it should have been more acrophobic than it is. I'm sure there are people who are definitely be triggered by it, but I just, like, I'm someone who hates. I'm not afraid of heights because I can fly okay.
Yeah,
but I want. But I, you know,
you're just not going to look down when you're up.
But
high.
If I'm like at work and I'm at like the top of a ladder in the middle of an aisle, and there's like nothing for me to glom onto if I should happen to fall, that kind of freaks me out. But you know, I think the movie would have benefited from more of that. One of the things I did think of was the Mission Impossible movie where Tom Cruise climbs the Burj Khalifa, and how visceral that is because he is actually on the side of the Burj Khalifa. And I think that was something that was missing from this movie, was just like the visceral kind of like, you do like, do not fall, because a lot of it is CGI, of course. And at no point was I worried that the Rock character was going to fall to his death. I mean, A, because that's not that movie, but B, because it was mostly, you know, visual effects stuff. So
sorry, I zoned out there for a bit when you started talking about Tom Cruise movie.
I know why, but he has promised he will get killed doing a Mission Impossible stunt, so we'll see what happens.
I mean, just generally, I think that, like I said, I think this movie did what it set out to do, which was just set up a number of opportunities for Dwayne Johnson to be tough, to do really wacky things, to you know, fight and climb and save his family.
And from the director of Dodgeball.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I'll go home and watch Dodgeball now, too.
So, there you go.
Now, I will say I will watch... I mean, I'll pretty much watch anything with Dwayne Johnson in it. Like,
yeah.
He.
No, I agree.
He is just a... Yeah, you're right. He's just so charismatic that even the worst films...
He's the closest we have to a movie, closest thing we have to a movie star today. And that's,
yeah, and how weird is that, right? Yeah. Like, of all the people, and to think, you know, just this guy who used to be a WWE star.
Still dips his toe in.
Yep.
Anyway, that's it for the show. You can find us on endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media on Twitter, End Credits Radio Show, or on... No, that's our Facebook one, End Credits Radio Show. Our Twitter one is shorter, End Credits Radio. Candace, where can people find you on the internet?
It's very easy. It's Sin48 everywhere, C-I-N-N and the digits 48. And that's Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and Tumblr and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, mine's a bit more complicated. You can find me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram, but you can also find me on guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, and I'll be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. We will see you then.